Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Matt McLaughlin here, and thank you for joining me for another episode of Living History. I hope you're really enjoying the new season. I'm certainly enjoying bringing it to you. We've got lots of great episodes coming up in the future. And you may recall that in the lead up to the launch of the recent season, we did some re-releases of some of my favorite episodes from the past. And we've had a really great response to that. A lot of people have contacted me to say how much they've enjoyed hearing those old episodes, ones that they may have missed the first time around, because we've been going now for, 5 or 6 years now, and we've got several hundred episodes that we've recorded. So people have really been enjoying hearing those previous episodes they may have missed first time around. So I decided I'll keep bringing them to you for at least the near future. So this is an episode that is very close to my heart. In 2019, we did a whole series of special episodes to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon. And by far the highlight of that was I got to speak to Charlie Duke, one of the astronauts who walked on the moon. I think he was the 10th man to walk on the moon, and he was involved in all stages of the entire Apollo campaign. So it was a real highlight to speak to him, a wonderful privilege to speak to him. And it was one of our most popular episodes we've ever done, unsurprisingly. So I thought I'd bring that one to you as well. So please enjoy this repeat and look out for some very special interviews we have coming up, some very special episodes, but also a special announcement. We're currently building our plans for subscribers. We've got lots of great extra content, and we're building a plan to release a subscription model where for a few extra dollars a month, you can join us and get some fantastic exclusive content. So look out for that in the coming weeks as well. But in the meantime, please enjoy this interview with Charlie Duke.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground.
That's one small step for man, one
by a it was really dramatic. Rough terrain, cratered, hilly, and I kept thinking, nobody's ever been here before. I'm on the moon.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Living History and to the third installment of our special episodes dedicated to commemorating 50 years since man landed on the moon. And please, if you've been enjoying these episodes, and indeed all the episodes we're putting out on the podcast, please subscribe. If it's through Apple Podcasts or through Stitcher or through Radio Public or Google Play or Spotify or any of the other channels we use to get this podcast out, please subscribe so you don't miss out on good content. And also, if you're enjoying it, give us a review, give us a star rating, write a few words about us, because the more people that know about the podcast, the more people that are out there enjoying it, the more great episodes we can bring you. In terms of great episodes, there's not going to be one much better than this one, because today we are speaking to Charlie Duke. Charlie Duke was an astronaut on Apollo 16 in 1972. He was the 10th man to walk on the moon and one of only four men alive today who have stood on the lunar surface. It was an incredible honor to speak to an Apollo astronaut about that experience of flying to the moon. I spoke to Charlie from his home in Texas. It was an absolute honor. He's a wonderful man. You'll recognize his voice because not only did Charlie participate in Apollo 16, he was also the voice of Mission Control during Apollo 11. When Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, when Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon in 1969, you'll recognize Charlie Duke's southern accent as the voice from Mission Control as he spoke to them as they walked on the moon for the first time. So Charlie was intimately involved in the entire Apollo program. It was just an absolute privilege, one of the highlights of my life, to speak to him. And I'm sure you will enjoy this interview with Charlie Duke, Apollo astronaut, the 10th man to walk on the moon. Charlie, thank you very much for joining us on Living History.
It's my pleasure. Enjoy being in Australia and look forward to coming again next year.
We look forward to seeing you out here. Now, the moon landing was 50 years ago. Does it feel that long to you?
Not really, but it's you look at all of the water over the dam, if you will, of 12 moonwalkers, only four of us left alive, and a lot of the other crewmen have passed on, and so you really think about it, it's been a long time. But to me personally, it doesn't feel like that long.
You started your career in the Air Force as a fighter pilot and a test pilot. Was flying something you always wanted to do?
Not really. I grew up in a very small town in South Carolina, and there weren't many airplanes around when I was a kid. I wanted to serve my country, though, so I got to the Naval Academy. And there, I fell in love with airplanes. The Navy had some pre-World War II seaplanes that they took every midshipman up in for three rides. And open cockpit, bi-wing, fabric-covered planes. And I just loved it. So I said, that's what I want to do is be a pilot. And back then, you had a choice, Naval Aviation or Air Force. There wasn't an Air Force Academy back when I graduated in 1957. So I chose the Air Force, and it was the right decision for me.
What was your favorite aircraft that you flew in during your Air Force career?
Probably it depends on the mission. In Germany for 3 years, I was a fighter interceptor pilot. And the last 2 years, we flew the F-102, which was a really good interceptor. It had missiles internal and good radar. We sat alert and scrambled on 5-minute notice and on unidentified things coming across the Iron Curtain. And so it was very dramatic. And I love flying instruments, and we flew in all kinds of weather. So that was a nice airplane. Then when I became a test pilot, at test pilot school, we had the F-104 Starfighter. And that was really interesting. We flew it two really good missions. One was a zoom maneuver, we called it, and you could get it max speed at 35,000 feet and pull up and just let it go, and it'd get to 100,000 feet, and it's really really exciting. And then we had another mission called low lift to drag. It was a steep landing approaches like the space shuttle ended up doing. So that was probably my favorite airplane at test pilot school.
And how did you make the transition from Air Force to the space program?
Well, I was still, when I was at test pilot school, I graduated in August of 1965. And in September, I saw an article in the paper that says NASA's having another astronaut selection. And it listed the criteria, and I filled every one of the criteria. So I had to ask my boss. I said, how do I apply? And so anyway, we found out, and I applied and got selected. So I was still on active duty in the Air Force when I went to NASA. So I was most of us were active duty military, but we never wore our uniforms. We always had civilian clothes on since NASA is a civilian agency.
Was this in 1966 you joined NASA?
That's correct. In April 66, there were 19 of us selected. Three in my test pilot school class were selected. And we all got to go to the moon. I wasn't a moon. They were. I was the only moonwalker, but the other two guys got to be what's called command module pilots. One on Apollo 15, one on Apollo 14.
Just extraordinary. Was there a feeling at this stage, Charlie, that President Kennedy's deadline that he'd set for walking on the moon at the end of the decade, was there a feeling that this was going to be met by the people involved in the program?
No question. I thought we got there and we were moving well along. There were some hiccups, if you will, with the spacecraft, both the lunar module and the command module. But then in January 67, we had this tragic accident where the crew was killed in a test in the spacecraft. And that was a real shock and a real showstopper, if you will, for the program. But instead of giving up, NASA applied all of its resources. The astronaut office says, we're not giving up. We mourned our compatriots, and then we went to work, doubled our effort to make sure we finished by the end of 1969. 18 months later, a little bit more, October of 1968, we had our first Apollo command module mission, and that was Earth orbit to check out the vehicle. Then the next mission was 2 months later or thereabouts in December. Apollo 8 went to the moon, which I think was probably one of the boldest, riskiest missions NASA ever approved. Because once they launched to the moon, they were on there. Everything had to work. They were not going to make it. And it's only the second mission on the spacecraft and the first mission where people were on the Saturn rocket, but everything worked great. And so we were on our way. And, you know, then 7 months later, in July next year, we landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon. So we accomplished the goal with 5 months to spare.
You mentioned that terribly tragic fire on Apollo 1 that killed astronauts Grissom, Chaffee and White. I've heard other people involved in the Apollo program say that in spite of that huge price to pay, in some ways it was a turning point for the good because that changed everyone's attitude about safety and about how that program should operate. Did you feel that was the case after that terrible accident?
No question. We started focusing on quality control. We had a very intensive review of our command module, and we ended up changing the hatch, changing some of the test procedures, changing the escape routes off the launch pad. And so it turned out to be a good for the program at the expense of the Apollo 1 crew. No question, NASA got more safety conscience and also quality control.
You mentioned the other astronauts that you were on the program with. What was your relationship like with those other astronauts? Because you're all, you know, high-achieving military men. Was there a rivalry amongst the astronauts, or was there just a feeling that we're all teammates and we're all in this together?
I would say the latter, that we're all teammates and we're in it together. We were, competing for a certain number of slots, but there was no way to really compete. You just did your job that you were assigned, and if you weren't on a crew, you had additional duties. Not only were you training in geology and systems, how NASA worked, you were learning all of that stuff, and so. Out of your additional duty, people started getting selected. There'd been 54 astronaut selected. And from before the fire at Kennedy until that next summer, we had five other astronauts killed in airplane accidents and an automobile accident. And then John Glenn had retired. Scott Carpenter retired. We had people medically grounded. So the cadre of astronauts available to flight was like around 42 to 44. I'd have to count up exactly, but that number. So we were all in the mix, but nobody knew what you had to do to get a flight. There was no test, no fill in the blanks. You do this and you get a flight. You just did your job to the best of your ability and hope for the best. And so I think that's what happened in my case. I was a support on Apollo 10, ended up in Mission Control. We had a great flight. I was Mission Control on Apollo 11 during the landing. And after that, I was put on a backup crew for Apollo 13, which meant back then from backup crew to flight crew was three flights later. So that's what happened. I flew on Apollo 16.
So Apollo 11, the famous one, we're celebrating 50 years this year. Tell us about your involvement in that, because you were CAPCOM, weren't you? The capsule communicator in Mission Control during that landing. So everyone would recognize your voice, even from this podcast, because those famous words that will live on in history, you were the voice from Mission Control in Houston. What was it like in that, particularly that 13 minutes, that descent, when they began their descent to the lunar surface? What was the atmosphere like in Mission Control during that 13 minutes?
I think it was confident tension. It got more and more tense as we continued the descent because these problems kept arising. There were four that I remember that were could have been showstoppers, really. First one was the communications. We kept having communication dropout, and one of the mission rules was after, let's say, 30 seconds without data, you were supposed to call on abort. So we kept losing data, but we regained it, and then we'd lose it again. This was early on in the descent. We finally got that figured out, and then we started having computer overloads, alarms. And when I saw that, my heart basically stopped and said, we're losing the computer. You needed a computer to land according to the mission rules, so it was going to be an abort. But the flight controllers in charge of the computer gave a positive response. We're go. And so we kept having these alarms, but the computer kept doing its job, which was guiding the spacecraft and controlling the spacecraft and flying the trajectory. And so it was doing everything it needed to do, but it was dropping off some of the tasks at the end of its compute cycle that it couldn't get through. And so it says that's overload, but what it was dropping off wasn't really that important. So we continued. Then we had, you can imagine, tension was really high. Everybody was focused on their consoles, listening. We gave a go for at pitch over, which was like 7,000 feet above the surface. And Neil saw the surface for the first time and realized the trajectory was wrong and he was going into a wrong place. So he had to level off and fly over this boulder field, if you will. Well, that resulted in minimum fuel. It took a lot of extra fuel. And so as he starts down, the tension was out through the roof in Mission Control, and very quiet, except for the propulsion controller. And he said 60 seconds flight. Well, what that meant to the crew was they had 60 seconds to land or we would call an abort Mission Control. Well, we called Eagle 30 seconds. and they still went on the ground, but they were close. And we could hear Buzz Aldrin say, picking up dust, 30 feet, down two or whatever it was. And, then, after that 30 second call, according to my stopwatch, 13 seconds later, we heard from the crew, contact, engine stop. So we never got to the abort call. And with basically 17 seconds before an abort call, we landed. So there was a great sigh of relief. And Neil Armstrong very calmly a few seconds later said, Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. Well, if you listen carefully to my transmission back, I was so excited I couldn't even say Tranquility. It came out twang. But I corrected myself and said, Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot. And so that was the truth, literally holding our breath. And so we made it. Had we gotten to the abort call at the altitude they were above the moon, Neil Armstrong had the prerogative to continue the landing. That was because that abort call was really with 4% fuel remaining, if I recall. And so that was enough to bring you down from 20 or 30 feet to a successful landing. Fortunately, we never had to make that decision, and we landed within limits and within mission rules.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You describe all the problems that Apollo 11 was having as it came in, and from the accounts that I've read and from what I've seen about it, it was very difficult. It was, you know, things weren't quite going to plan. How good a job did Neil Armstrong do in landing that spacecraft in those difficult conditions?
I would say I'd give him a grade of 100. He did great managing to level off and fly over inhospitable terrain to find a place that looked satisfactory. He made the decision, started down. It was just cool, control, and Buzz Aldrin also. But I think Neil was a perfect choice to be the commander of the first attempt. He was one of our most experienced test pilots and had a lot of experience. He'd proved his mettle on Gemini 8, which was out of control due to a thruster stuck on it. He managed to recover that vehicle and land safely. So I was pleased to see him make the first attempt. But there was no guarantee that Apollo 11 would be the first attempt. If Apollo 10 didn't go well, then they would have probably changed the flight plan and had another test flight, and so Apollo 12 would have been the first attempt. But Apollo 10 went so well, the commitment was, let's go land this thing. And he did an incredible job, both of them.
A couple of flights later, we had again, probably the second most famous of the Apollo missions with Apollo 13. And you were fairly closely involved in that mission as well, weren't you? And especially once things started to go wrong on Apollo 13.
I sure was. We were the backup crew. And if you recall, before the launch, a week or so, I caught the measles and exposed everybody to the measles. And on the backup crew and the prime crew, everybody had had the measles except Ken Mattingly. So the doctor said, well, he could get the measles at the moon. So there was a big discussion between flight medicine and the flight operations. And it was decided to remove Ken Mattingly and substitute Jack Schweikert, who I had trained with. And then when the accident occurred, when they lost the oxygen, Mattingly, myself, and John Young went to Mission Control, and we were there for 35 hours working diligently to develop the procedures and not only to get them on free return so they'd come back to Earth, but also to power up the lunar module and power down the command module. So John and I were working on the power up, and Mattingly was working on the power down. And so we worked tirelessly, and we were coming back from the moon before I got comfortable that we were really going to make it. Everybody breathed a sigh of relief that we were going to have enough consumables, water and oxygen and all of those things, electrical power, those things that could run out before we returned. But they didn't, because we had the right procedures of power up, power down.
Was there a feeling during that time that you were hoping against hope, you know, that there was really no chance to get them home, but you do what you can? Or was everyone just determined, no, we're going to do this, we're going to bring them back?
I think the first couple of hours there was, I wouldn't say a hopelessness, but we were in a dire situation, and we got to do something quick to make sure this thing lasts. And the lunar module was in really good shape, but we had to power it up, and now we had a lunar module. That lunar module was designed for two guys for 3 days. Now we got three guys for 4 days. How do you make it last? That was the big effort for the first 30 or 40 hours after the accident. And as the longer we went in the recovery time, the more confident everybody became that we're going to have enough stuff. And I guess it was about a few hours after we rounded the moon and started home, which still was probably 70 hours to go, I was confident that if Mission Control didn't make a mistake and the crew didn't make a major mistake, we had enough stuff, oxygen, electrical power, water, to get us back. And so things then developed into survival mode for the crew and for us. But we managed it right. And the last few hours before reentry, we had never powered down a command module, and it was not designed to power down. And so is it going to power up right? And so you saw Apollo 13, that Mattingly powering up that command module with minimum power usage was really critical. And he and all the engineers did a fantastic job.
You mentioned that movie, Charlie, Apollo 13. Was that a fairly accurate representation of what was happening during those days?
It's probably one of the best space movies I've seen about Apollo. Tom Hanks and Ron Howard were a stickler for accuracy, and so it was real good, really accurate as far as the technical side goes. One thing, of course, was that when they were in Mission Control in the movie, they were always the same people. But that's not true. We cycle crews, flight control crews through on a regular basis. And so there were more than those people in the movie that were responsible for the recovery. But the spacecraft was, and all of the space flight scenes were actually zero gravity. They were in the back of the, what we call the vomit comet, making this movie. And there were a few little technical glitches, but it was not anything important. And in fact, a couple of the glitches, what they had technically, made it easier for the audience who were not technical to understand what was going on.
Moving forward to your mission where you walked on the moon, Apollo 16. I mean, gee, where do we begin? I won't ask you anything as inane as what was it like to walk on the moon, because I'm sure you've answered that question many times. But what I'm interested in is, did all the training you'd done, all the communication with the other astronauts who'd been to the moon, all the knowledge that NASA gave you, did that prepare you for the experience of being on that massive Saturn V rocket, of blasting into space and then eventually landing and walking on the moon?
There's no question about it. We debriefed not just us, but every crew and every astronaut sat in on the debriefing after every mission. We spent a couple of days, as I recall, asking questions, and they were briefing us about this system, that system, and this needs to change and that needs to change. We listened to every crew on the moon about the problems with this tool and that tool and this experiment and that experiment. And so we kept modifying things as we went along. Our geology training got very specific. The simulators were accurate. And so we certainly build on the experience on Apollo 16 from the first four landings. So ours was, at the time, the longest on the moon, and the second with a car. And so it was the last three missions of the landings were really the science bread and butter, if you will, of Apollo, because we were 3 days on the moon. And you could get a lot of science done and a lot of rock collecting. So our flight certainly build on the shoulders of the other four landings. We learned all about the peculiarities of the Saturn rocket, that it was each one had a different basically vibration signature. And when we lifted off, even though I knew it was supposed to shake, it was shaking so much I thought there was something wrong. But it was just the character of our vehicle. We were on trajectory, mission control, you're go, and John Young saying we go, and and so even with the shaking on the first stage, we shut down right on schedule. And on the first stage, and the second two stages took us into orbit. And the third stage, we reignited and on the way to the moon. So we didn't have any problems during the ascent, Earth orbit phase, and then translunar injection. When we separated and turned around to retrieve the lunar module, that looked like we had a fuel leak in the lunar module. There was these, looked like fireflies was floating away, a whole lot of them. And so we turned on the television and let mission control look at it. And so after we docked up and got on our way, they wanted us to go over and power up the lunar module to see if anything was leaking. And so we did, and the lunar module checked out perfectly. So we continued our mission. And we didn't find out what the hell that was until we landed on the moon. And I got outside and went around to take a picture of this area of the lunar module. And what it was thermal paint peeling off. It either was applied, something happened to cause it all to peel off. And those flakes were just tiny bits of paint floating away. So we had a good lunar module.
You mentioned that you spent 3 days on the moon. I think that's just extraordinary, because you landed on the moon in 1972, and less than 3 years earlier, when the first landing took place, Apollo 11, they spent less than 3 hours on the moon.
Well, we didn't have 3 days outside. We had 3 days on the surface, but most of that was spent in the cabin, in the lunar module. We were actually outside a little over 20 hours, which was scheduled for us. The Apollo 11 was on the moon, I think, a little less than 24 hours. They were actually outside 3 hours, and they only had one excursion. We had three. So Apollo 15, 16, and 17 designed their flight plan on the moon to have three excursions, three rest periods. So we divided up the 72 hours into three 24-hour chunks of time.
Charlie, we're all really familiar with that absolutely famous audio of the final 13 minutes of Apollo 11 when they descended onto the moon. But could you share with us your experiences on Apollo 16, on that moment when you began to descend and touch down on the moon?
We had a lot of confidence that mission control tracking was accurate. The engine fired precisely. We had a lot of backups to make sure that we were on the right trajectory and everything performing. We had a major problem in the command module, service module. The main engine, the service propulsion system, was to be fired on the backside of the moon for him to change his orbit, and we would then the next hour we were scheduled to land. But he had a problem with the main engine. There was one of the control loops was out. So now we're down to one control loop, and according to the mission rules, that's an abort. Come home. So you can imagine the disappointment John and I had at that point. But as we came around from the backside, mission control looked at the data and they said, stand by. At least they didn't say, come home right away. So it took them two orbits. And finally they said, well, we know what's wrong. We can't fix it, but here's a workaround. So now we got two systems, and they said, next time around, you guys go for landing. So, yahoo, you know. We were so excited. So 6 hours behind schedule for us, we touched down into Descartes Highlands.
It's just such an extraordinary experience, obviously, going to the moon. You know, you're one of a handful of people who've had this incredible experience. I mean, just what parts of that mission really stand out for you, Charlie? What were the highlights, the bits that will always stay with you?
Well, the liftoff in the Saturn was certainly dramatic. It was a huge vehicle, and the first stage had a vibration about it, but that was all. And then it performed flawlessly on every mission. So that was unique. Then the first view of Earth as we started out to the moon was this jewel of Earth of blue and white and brown just hung up there in the blackness of space. And we were about 32,000 kilometers away at this point, and you could see the whole circle of Earth. And out one other window, you could see the moon, but you don't, it was just the rest of space is just black. You, with the sun shining out in space, which is all the time, you don't see any stars. So you're looking out into the blackness of space. And there's the Earth hung up on nothing, and there's the moon, and everything else is black except where the sun is. It's a velvety black. It feels like you could reach out and touch it. It's so vivid.
What was that moment like, that first glimpse of the lunar surface as you went into lunar orbit? I mean, you were seeing the moon closer than just about any other person on Earth had ever seen it. What was that moment like when you got up close to the moon?
That was another dramatic moment. We were in darkness when we inserted in the lunar orbit, but a few minutes later we came into sunlight, and the sunrise on the moon is dramatic because there's no atmosphere. It doesn't look like sun coming up slowly like it does on Earth, where the atmosphere gets bright first and then the sun, you'll see on the moon it's just bang, you got sunlight and long shadows, very rough on the backside of the moon. Totally different than the terrain on the front side. And then, of course, the landing, probably the most dramatic thing for me on the whole mission was the landing. Very dramatic landing. You're coming into a place that you really haven't seen in detail. Our photographs for our landing site had resolution of 15 meters. That meant things 15 meters and less you didn't see. And so you pitch over at 7,000 feet, and there's the major craters you see in your photograph you studied, like the 500 meters. But the little ones just start appearing. And, man, there's a lot of craters down here, a lot of rocks. And John had to really maneuver to find a place to set down, and he did a fantastic job.
That must have been pretty special as well, the moment when you first set foot on the lunar surface.
We were so excited. I was like a little kid at Christmas and birthday, all rolled into one. I didn't have any fear that I was going to sink out of sight, of course. I was number 10 on the moon, so I just jumped off the ladder and onto the footbed and jumped right onto the moon and started just having this extraordinary 72-hour experience. I felt right at home. I was excited. I was in awe. I was in wonder. The moon was probably the most dramatic terrain that you could possibly imagine. Nothing like it on Earth at all. And so you're there looking at this gray surface that's covered with this very, very fine dust like powder. And so everywhere you walked, you left your footprints. You looked off at the horizon, and the moon was very bright everywhere you looked. But at the horizon, it turned to instant darkness since there's no atmosphere. And you look up into the sky, and the only object you could see was the Earth. But for us, the Earth was right overhead. And as you look up in your Apollo helmet, you can't see up straight up. So we couldn't see it. But the rest of the sky was just this blackness. And of course, the sun, but it's so bright, you don't look at it with just the sun visors we had. They were not capable of looking strictly at the sun. It was really dramatic. Rough terrain, cratered, hilly, just a dramatic. And I kept thinking, nobody's ever been here before. I'm on the moon, and nobody's ever been here before. John and I are the first ever to explore this part of the moon.
It's just extraordinary stuff, Charlie, and thank you for sharing those reminiscences with us. Just finishing up, after all these decades, why do you think it's important that we went to the moon? What is the legacy of this incredible operation that you were involved in?
Well, as President Kennedy said, it was going to challenge the resources and the technology and the engineering capability of the United States. We wanted to win the space race with the Russian to restore our technological leadership, if you will, in the world. And it turned out that the technologies that were rooted in the space race were very important for the economy of the United States and now the world economy. So it was a good investment, not only in our economy, but in our, 400,000 people employed. It was a tremendous inspiration for our country to do this and to prove our mettle, if you will, that we can do this. And so that carried over throughout Apollo. And I see that being birthed again. Let's return to the moon. And hopefully within the next decade, we'll return to the moon, hopefully with a lunar lander. So we're looking, our administration is seeking a return to the moon. And so hopefully we can get Congress to fund it. And that they would have the forward outlook and the enthusiasm that the administration of John Kennedy and others back in the Apollo days had, and we can reach out to the moon again. I think it'd be very challenging. There's a lot of interest in our young people to study engineering and science and math and the technologies that it takes. I'd make a lot of talks, and I see a lot of interest in our younger generation. In 2017, NASA had another selection of astronauts, and they had 18,000 applications. So there's not a lack of interest in the millennial generation in space.
Well, I think we all agree with you. There's just something so wonderful and so magical about this idea that we can go into space and head to the moon. Charlie, thank you so much for sharing your memories and your thoughts about this, because it's been a great honor to speak to you, and just thank you very much for being involved.
I'm glad it worked out and we had good communications. God bless and have a great day.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.